May it please the Court, good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jennifer Oliva, and I'm the Deputy State Solicitor at the Delaware Department of Justice. I appear here today on behalf of the Superior Court for the State of Delaware. At counsel table with me is Alona Kershon, Deputy Attorney General. The reason the State appears before the Court today is to discuss the topic of separation of powers. The Chief Justice's authority to administer and supervise the state court system is clearly delineated in the state constitution in Article 4, Section 13. That provision gives the Chief Justice broad powers that were explained by Chancellor Quillen in his 1974 letter decision, cited by both sides substantially in this case, describe those powers as follows. Absolute and unqualified. The broadest possible administrative authority, encompassing all facets of the internal management of the court system, that which can be exercised at any time at his convenience and desirability, and that which undoubtedly, quote, reaches every employee within every court or court-related office in the state. What's happened in this case is that an executive branch board, an inferior tribunal of the Superior Court, attempted to take jurisdiction of the Superior Court of the State of Delaware. And the court argued that that violated the statutory limits of the jurisdiction of that board, which is created by the General Assembly by statute, and its jurisdiction is limited by the General Assembly by that statute, the Public Employment Relations Act. The board ruled that Chancellor Quillen's letter controlled and said that Chancellor Quillen's determination at the conclusion of his expository that I just read to you describing the Chief Justice's powers, his provision that said the Chief Justice's powers do not conflict with Paris' predecessor statute, which was the 1965 statute in place at the time in 1974 when the decision was made. It can't conflict with those powers because the Chief Justice hasn't acted on those powers. Now, the state disagrees with that ruling because we think that it runs afoul of this court's decision in Biggs versus Corley in 1934. Biggs versus Corley decided the following controversy. In the General Assembly, post-election, two members of the Senate of this state were asked and appointed to other state offices, other public offices, and they had also been elected to their General Assembly seats in the Senate. There's a dual office prohibition provision in Article 2, Section 14 of the Delaware Constitution. The controversy was brought to this court, and the question asked was, well, the Lieutenant Governor hadn't acted on it, he hadn't called a special session, but this court hear the case and rule that these two individuals had implicitly given up their General Assembly Senate seats by accepting these other two state jobs. The court looked at the law and said, as a matter of law in Delaware, no question about it, you can't hold two offices. So they had implicitly given up their seats. But ultimately what the court did here was declined to take jurisdiction over the case. Why did it do that? It looked at the Delaware Constitution. In Article 2, Section 4, which is the article obviously that pertains to the legislature, the General Assembly has the sole and exclusive authority to judge the qualifications of its own members. And this court explicitly said in that case, judging is something we do every day. As opponent power of this court, we know if anyone else came before us besides a senator in the General Assembly and we had to make this decision, we would easily rule under Article 2, Section 14, no dual office holding. Violates the Constitution of the State of Delaware. But we have to look at the provision under Section 4 of Article 2, which says only the General Assembly can judge the qualifications of its own members. And when they looked at that provision, they said, we don't have jurisdiction because that jurisdiction has been subscribed to a different branch of government, and it would violate separation of powers. The reason why we think Biggs conflicts with the ultimate conclusion in Chancellor Quillen's 1974 letter opinion is because Chancellor Quillen sort of said, the way we phrase it is, a power that lies dormant can be usurped. The General Assembly can do something as long as it doesn't conflict with something that yet hasn't been done by the court, even if the court has that exclusive power delegated to it by the Delaware Constitution. We think Biggs says otherwise. It's a fact in that case.
Is there any role for consent, acquiescence, whatever the term might be, in the separation of powers context, and has there been consent or acquiescence here?
To answer your first question, Justice Ridley, absolutely there can be consent, but that didn't happen in that particular case. He just had not acted at all. That's what they had held. But absolutely. We've never argued the separation of powers is sort of three lines in the sand or something of that sort. If consulted, the Chief Justice has acquiesced to lots of things. He's agreed to sort of go with the budgeting process of the executive branch, and his rules make that explicitly clear. So he's decided in his own rules to acquiesce to lots of things, workers' compensation, some of these other workers' rights statutes. He explicitly provides those rights. He's explicitly acquiesced to that, and that's his decision and his discretion to make. So certainly that can happen. But just like all other constitutional powers, and just like Biggs versus Corley, this one's been written off way too easily here. When we waive constitutional powers in this state, and this court has been clear about it, it has to be an express statement that you're waiving that power.
So if the order that had been entered here explicitly, unambiguously created in the non-merit system judicial branch employees a right to be represented by a union, that would qualify under all of your tests, correct?
Absolutely. Yes, sir. Absolutely. Good question. In fact, when we get to the rules, there's several problems that we've discussed, but there's structural problems there.
Okay, but I mean, if that's correct, then doesn't the issue boil down to whether this particular order is sufficiently clearly states that intent or doesn't?
Yes, sir. We do agree with that. I wanted to caveat the fact that we didn't agree with the Chancellor's letter, but we still do think that his ruling controls here because the Chief Justice has acted, so even if that was good law.
Well, you're saying the use it or lose it rule doesn't apply, but in any case, it's been used here.
Yes, sir. That's absolutely right. And how it's been used here is, in fact, this court and the Chief Justices of this court started enacting administrative directives as far back as the late 60s and early 70s, and they culminated in these comprehensive rules, which are referred to as the judicial branch personnel rules. PERP didn't take those into consideration when it made its decision, but then did rely on them substantially in its arguments before Chandler below. Our argument there is the following, and I think that it's a really important point to make. There are three references to either the word union or collective bargaining in the judicial branch personnel rules as promulgated recently, I think effective April 1st of this year. However, they're all qualified with may or might or where applicable type language. So the Chief Justice, under the rule that I've laid out and under the rule of Biggs versus Corley and under the rule of most courts who've looked at this that have this constitutional provision, and I say that because I think it's very important. A lot of the states that are listed out, when you look at this big state chart that opposing counsel has given to you, they either don't have, most of these jurisdictions either don't have this expansive, broad, absolute plenary power that they've granted to their state Supreme Court or the head of that court, or they have a conflicting constitutional provision. And a classic case of that is the state of Michigan, where Michigan came out agreeing with us here. It's a case that we use in brief, in our opening brief extensively, said, no, you can't take jurisdiction over the state Supreme Court, their version of the PERB. But they had three dissents in that case, and all three dissenters relied on the fact that there was a constitutional provision in the Michigan Constitution that said public employees had the right to collective bargain. So there was conflicting constitutional provisions. Some jurisdictions have the latter, but not the former. So you can assume that the public employees there, they have a constitutional provision they can rely on. The Chief Justice or the state Supreme Court might not. There's a lot of different things you see. Sometimes you see a statute, and this is the thing that we probably see the most in the states that will permit judicial employees.
But your point is that under the current constitutional and statutory scheme, the Chief Justice can either grant the right to collective bargaining and union representation or withhold it.
Absolutely right. Yes, Your Honor, that is our point.
And to the extent that there's some dispute resolution mechanism that goes along with that, that would also be within the power of the Chief Justice to define by administrative order. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. In fact, the entire system and structure doesn't make sense given if you look at the rules. You can look at the few references, and as I've said, they're qualified. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I've made the point, and I think that that if the Chief Justice was going to grant this right, he would have done so explicitly, and he would have had to put provisions and things in place that make sense, and he didn't here. And the Chancellor does sort of, with all due respect to him, blow past that. He says, there's no mention of the para, but I've got to find something that makes this work. Then he says, there's no mention of the PERB, but the PERB's the only board in the state right now that hears these labor relations disputes, so I have to go with the PERB. That makes no sense that he wouldn't pick who his exclusive bargaining representative was. He's entitled to do that even under the PERA. He has to pick who that is. He's not going to defer to a different branch of government to bargain for him. That would be nonsensical, and certainly that in and of itself would violate the separation of powers. And he'd have to set up what the mechanism was. And that's why I point to these other jurisdictions where the courts and the legislature have gotten together and decided, what's the structure look like? How does it look? How would you like it to work? And they've set aside a specific statute for the courts that work for the courts. And there's almost, in every one of those jurisdictions, there's less that those employees can bargain for than some of the other employees because of the special nature of the work that the courts do. And that point brings me to my next point, which is that the state merit employees, in particular here, we'll talk about the family court because they're often a foil to the superior court. And in this entire dispute, they've been raised quite a bit. Family court employees have been merit employees since the State Merit Act was passed. And so far as that's concerned, the merit statute and the PERA work together as they must. And it's constantly being amended, actually, so they work together a bit better over time when you look at the amendments. The family court management and their exclusive bargaining representative doesn't have to bargain over a whole host of topics that are listed in 5938C. And 5938D says here are the things you have to bargain for. So those two provisions say this is excluded, the merit rules apply, and D says here's what you can bargain for. In the current context, if you want to believe the Chief Justice, it's been clear in the judicial branch personnel rules that he's given his Superior Court non-judicial, non-merit employees the right to bargain. He's given himself carte blanche. He's going to have to bargain on everything. They'd have more authority to bargain with him than any other employees in the state of Delaware in any other context. So again, you have to make a lot of leaps of logic here to get to the point where you're going to take these three qualified provisions that say things like may or where applicable and that are very similar to the merit rules. And the state court administrator was clear, I think I wrote this in my reply brief, that she wanted to get a system that was closer to the merit system because there's a lot of good case law on it, things like that. But she explicitly said that. And they look very similar, but that those merit employees, there's a whole list of things under the PERA they can't bargain for, and these employees would be able to bargain for, right now, effectively everything.
Can you help me understand your position on this point between
yes,
merit and non-merit?
Yes, sir.
Are you citing to the judicial branch personnel rules to demonstrate the intent of the directive, or does it matter in the sense that if the Chief Justice said in that document or in some other document, there shall be no collective bargaining within the judicial branch. That would trump the merit and non-merit process?
In my view, yes, that would be the case.
Okay.
That would be the case because, as I've said, the rule is he can consent or acquiesce or not object. But if he does, then we have a separation of powers problem. If he wants to do things differently, then we have a separation of powers. That's the Chancellor Cohen's letter's ultimate ruling, is if he does something that conflicts and it's a statute versus his constitutional authority, his constitutional authority trumps the statute. And I can't think of an argument better than Chancellor Cohen's argument when it comes to that. That just must be the case. So what I would say about the family court employees and what I said at the time was, there was already acquiescence. And at the time, in 1974, the court didn't have this comprehensive system of rules, so there was a lot of acquiescence on personnel-type matters, which makes sense historically if you look at the history of this. They'd already been in the merit system. They already had the right. They had the explicit statutory right to bargain. And the court hadn't done anything different. It hadn't cataloged rules or come up with its own grievance procedure. Didn't have this comprehensive set of rules that talked about promotions and leaves and transfers and those sorts of things that you bargain for under the CBAs. That didn't exist. And so the happy medium for Chancellor Quinn was that rule. Now, and it would be up to the Chief Justice, obviously, probably would not want to disturb a longstanding system like that, especially if he thought that it worked. But if it was absolutely not working for the court system for some reason, and he wanted to do things differently under his constitutional authority, my argument would be that, yes, he could do it. His constitutional authority over those employees would absolutely trump the merit system, which is just the statute, and the para, which is just the statute. And I think it's also important to understand here that the public employees don't have a constitutional right to collective bargaining in this state. But the executive branch and the legislative branch also lack this similar authority, even over their own employees. Not only does it not say anywhere in the Delaware Constitution that the legislature has some, you know, authority over public employees, it doesn't even give them a similar provision with respect to their own employees. So if I was here representing the General Assembly, I'd have a much tougher argument. And that's why I said I don't think the General Assembly structured the PERB and structured the para. And what I mean by that is the PERB is an executive branch agency. The governor appoints all three board members. It's exclusively operating the executive branch. There is not one collective bargaining agreement in this state that's not been signed on the top line by an HRM employee or somebody who works in OMB. That's the designee of the director of the Office of Management Budget, who is an employee that's appointed by the governor. They would have structured it. I'm not saying it's a bad thing about collecting bargaining. It just doesn't make any sense. When you look at these other states, the legislature might have its own statute, which says our comptroller general, like in this case, will be our exclusive bargaining rep. Here's who will appoint people to the board. In this particular example with this court, Chief Justice has passed a rule, and we know that rulemaking, this court has been clear on this. No one can usurp his authority to publish rules, but Supreme Court Rule 87 says, created the administrative office of the courts. It says in there that that person is exclusively responsible for personnel. It's clear as day that that's what he intended, and then he promulgated the rules. So my view would be on that the system has to match up at least to some extent that makes sense with what he said, and it just doesn't. And I think the General Assembly, I can't tell you, I think they would say the same thing. And about 95% of the time in the code of the state of Delaware, when we're talking about state or state agency, we're talking about the executive branch of government. This court has never been called the state agency. There's not one example in the books that I could find throughout this four appeal process or this court or the Superior Court of Delaware has ever been called the state agency. I mean, that's avoided. They're not like the state universities, who are not a separate branch of government, who don't have, they weren't born of the Constitution. They're statutory creatures, just like the PERB, and they've been merit employees. I mean, that's the Delaware State case. That's their other example. It's a big case that they keep using. Delaware State University is not like the Supreme Court of Delaware in multiple respects that are pertinent and relevant to this analysis. And that's the only case on state agency that the other side has cited here. There's none calling the courts a state agency. And so it's ambiguous. The term is ambiguous, state or state agency. We've said that in lots of cases. So then you have to look and see, would it create a conflict to interpret those terms to include the courts? And the state's argument here is that it would. It would create a separation of powers conflict, and thus that should be avoided. The state's final argument is that if it's not enough to look at Supreme Court Rule 87, the Chief Justice's absolute exclusive express plenary power under Article 4, Section 13, the rules that have been passed by this court since the late 60s and early 70s and are now comprehensive and all-inclusive over the non-judicial, non-merit, in this case applies to the Superior Court bailiffs, then let's look again at the Delaware Code and think about what the legislature was thinking. 10 Delaware Code, Section 522, is explicit that the Superior Court itself has plenary power over its bailiffs. It's always been that way. I think that this statute's been characterized by opposing counsel as something like a Civil War era statute. I'm not certain why that's relevant, but we make the point we have in our briefs that the statute's been amended. It was indeed passed during the Civil War. It's been amended over time, and every time it's been amended into the 70s, the legislature's given the court more, not less, authority over those particular employees.
Could I ask, based upon what you've said so far, would it follow that the Chief Justice could take a step that would be inconsistent with that statute?
I would argue that yes, he could, because that's just a statute. But I do, yes, ma'am, I think that's a great question, actually. I use the statute to demonstrate that the General Assembly's intent, where it was ambiguous here with state and state agency. But I absolutely agree with your last statement, ma'am. But
so that statute is, to some extent, beside the point in terms of where the authority lies with respect to setting rules for collective bargaining?
Yes, ma'am. I agree with that. I was using it more of a General Assembly's intent, and they've revisited it multiple times. The canon of construction, and we all know that whenever you invoke a canon of construction, there's one on the other side. There's famous law review articles on that. But their canon of construction is the Paris passed in 1994, and the statute's passed, it's a Civil War statute. But there's another canon of construction, and it's the one that we cite, which is one that is specific, and it says Superior Court and Superior Court bailiffs requires peace officers, plenary power, duty to appoint, dismiss, serve at the pleasure. Those are the words that are used there versus state or state agency in the para that statute would control. And there's good case law in Delaware that's...
You're down to 3 minutes of your rebuttal. Did you want to save it?
I actually would, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is William Bowser. I'm representing the Delaware Public Employment Relations Board. Joining me here is Kathleen McCormick at the Council's table. This issue on this appeal is a denial of a writ of prohibition, as the Court knows, requested by the Superior Court against the PERB, which was denied by the Chancery Court. The essential issue, then, to be decided is whether the Public Employment Relations Act, or I'll call PERA throughout my presentation, can be applied to the Superior Court to allow its bailiffs and peace officers to organize. I submit that there are four separate inquiries that this Court has to make a determination in this case. First, does the PERA, by its terms, apply to the Superior Court? Second, does the judicial branch personnel rules, which I'll call personnel rules for short, do they prohibit the application of PERA to the Superior Court? Third, does the separation of powers doctrine prohibit application? And finally, does Section 522 of Tendell Code, the Code, prohibit application of PERA? Turning to the first question, and which was addressed at the end of opposing counsel's presentation, PERA applies to public employers, which include the state and any agency thereof. That's in Section 1302. Until, frankly, its reply brief, the Council for Superior Court has only made sort of a half-hearted argument that PERA did not apply, saying that it was an open question, there wasn't much law. Of course, that's ignoring Chancellor Quillen's letter opinion in Family Court, who ruled that the court system as a constitutional branch of government was included in the phrase state, not state agency, in state, and that the definition of PERA's predecessor, and by the way, PERA has exactly the same scope, was to be all-inclusive. He stated that to exclude the judicial branch would render the, quote, phrase state of Delaware to mere surplusage. Thus, as a matter of practice, following the Family Court opinion, judicial employees in this state have been organized for 30 years since that decision, and as late as 1996 were certified again in the Family Court. Now, in the reply brief for the very first time, and I've heard it here today, the Superior Court contends that PERA is only applied to the executive branch, and they primarily rely on a New Hampshire Supreme Court opinion. But there's nothing in para to support such a limitation. Section 1302P defines public employer to include the state. The use of the New Hampshire Supreme Court opinion is sort of trying to hammer a square peg into a round hole. In that case, the New Hampshire Supreme Court found that the state legislature was not, those employees were not within the definition of public employer. Did it on two reasons, however. The first is that the governor, his or herself, controlled the executive branch by statute all of the negotiations. That is not the case in Delaware. And in fact, in Delaware, every public employer bargains through its own designated representative, and that's set forth in 1302E. This difference was explicitly recognized in the New Hampshire decision. Contrary also to the council's assertion in their brief, Executive Order 76 does not require the Superior Court to use OMB as their designated negotiating representative. In fact, the Section 1 says of Executive Order 76, which was issued by Governor Ruth Ann Minner, public and higher education agencies and the judicial branch of government are urged to continue to use the Office of Management and Budget in an advisory role. Paragraph 2, which is cited in their brief, 2B, also makes clear that it is not required that OMB be a signatory on judicial contracts. In fact, it limits itself to executive branches.
Well, if, for example, then, the judicial branch had its own personnel rules which governed the rights of judicial branch employees to bargain collectively, that implies the branch could seek the assistance and expertise of OMB in both crafting and implementing those rules.
At the executive level, and that brings, yes, Your Honor, I think that the turning to the personnel rules, which I think you're referring to there, we submit that the Chief Justice has already sort of granted the rights.
Everybody keeps talking about the Chief Justice. Let's clear one thing up,
yes.
Whether it's credit or blame, the entire Supreme Court signs off on the administrative director.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I understand that. Let me just focus on those rules and what was used by the Chancellor in denying the writ of prohibition. There are three sections that I'd focus on, actually four sections I'd like to focus on. First of all is 18.1 that says that employees have the right to union representation at a grievance procedure. Council seizes on the word may. I can tell you that the word may means it's the employee's choice whether they'd like to have union representation at a grievance proceeding. That's what's called the Weingarten rights. It's a well-established principle of labor law that allows the employee to decide whether they want to have a union rep. Also says that 18.3 states that bargaining unit employees covered by a collective bargaining agreement shall use that collective bargaining process, the grievance process in the agreement itself, to have a collective bargaining agreement, you have to have organized employees and you have to have collective bargaining. So the Chancellor reached this conclusion that it wasn't logical to give employees union representation under the rules and not give them the right to organize in the first place, and that's as far as we have gotten so far. Also pointing out one rule that has been overlooked by opposing counsel, and that's in the rules themselves. They give they address the issue in the role of the Delaware Code. Section 1.4 of the rules states that in the event of a conflict with the Delaware Code, the Delaware Code takes precedent over these rules. I think that runs counter to the arguments made by the other side that these rules somehow preempt the field. I think it makes clear that the rules are to work in concert with the Delaware Code, and in fact that a recognition that labor relations of public employees is sort of a shared and cooperative venture between the various branches of government, as it always has been here.
Well, under the situation presented to us as a matter of fact, how is it cooperative? Why isn't it just a grab by the legislature and the executive branch through the PERB of powers granted to the Chief Justice under the state constitution?
Well, I don't think it is a power grab because if you look at the opinion of the justices using those factors that this court set down 30 years ago to decide whether there has been a power grab or separation of powers doctrine, a violation. Applying those rules, it will not be seen as a power grab. And I can, if the court pleases, the first factor is What is the essential nature of the power itself? And is it exclusive or is it a shared power? I submit to you that unlike the power to select employees, the general labor relations to grant employees rights in the workplace and setting terms and conditions has traditionally been a shared power. And I would just point beyond hiring and firing. If you look at the workers' comp, minimum wage, et cetera, if you look at it as a matter of practice, we have the family court employees who are already organized since 1974. The opposing counsel points to Article 4, Section 13, as some sort of grant, as a absolute prohibition. If I could just address that. As you know, this section gives the Chief Justice the general and administrative and supervisory powers over the courts. These powers include the power to adopt rules for the administration of justice and the conduct of business in any or all courts. I can tell you that the opposing counsel has not and cannot cite a single case from another jurisdiction where a similar power, this type of power, has been used to preclude the application of a paratype statute to judicial employees. We actually have looked at it, Your Honor. And that is, we've counted at least 11 states with very similar procedures that allow para to apply to judicial employees.
Let me stop you there just to make sure I understand your position, mm-hmm. Mr. Belcher. Let's assume that an administrative order is issued under the signature of the Chief Justice, signed off by all the other members of the court, and it provides, in substance, that the judicial branch employees shall not have a right of collective bargaining. Would that be legally self-sufficient? That is that under your view of the law, would that stand as written?
It would put Delaware out in the vast minority. But it would be, I submit that the court itself, if this case came back to this court with that rule, we would then have to look at whether this power is shared or not. And is it a power, you know, if the power was enacted afterwards and taking this power away, we'd have to look at the context. But I do believe that in likelihood that may solve the issue.
That would still be a reviewable exercise of
it possibly could be. It possibly could be. I would have a much...
Let me change the hypothetical slightly. Suppose the order were to provide that the judicial branch employees shall have the right of collective bargaining. However, the para and that mechanism shall not be applicable as far as resolution of disputes is concerned. How would that fare under your view of the law?
Well, certainly they would have the right to organize. The role of para, I still think, I'm trying to answer your question as directly as possible. I think you'd have to go back, and if it came before this court, the court would have to apply its same issues and say, is there a role for para? Is this a shared power? Does it violate the separation of powers? You would still have to go through the context, the three-pronged standard. What was the role of para? Was it a power grab? Is it cooperative in nature? Is it, what is the role, what is para trying to do? And it may turn out that para could survive. But I think that it would most likely go your way, and that is the sense that it would not, which I think where you're headed with that, is it would be a tougher argument for me to make, but not one that I think that the answer is predetermined, so to speak.
You cited a number of examples of employee relations that I understand that have some trouble fitting into a nexus of administering the courts, such as whether minimum wage applies or not, but in a whole list. We suffer from time to time legislative judgments that seem to impinge upon the rules of evidence, mm-hmm. seem to suggest that the court should be forced to accept a certain type of evidence in a certain type of case. We also have a multiplicity of demands that several subject matters be, quote, expedited, close quote. To the extent we suffer that and don't complain, have we forever abandoned our administrative ability to regulate case processing and security in the courtrooms by acquiescence?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And that goes to this essential or inherently judicial function. as opposed to the personnel, the wide area of human resource management that we're talking about here. And I will tell you, any time that that does happen, with the court's independence, or we touch on matters that are inherently judicial or essentially judicial, those of course the court has the power over the
we're talking about bailiffs in the Superior Court on these precise facts, correct?
That's all that's before the court.
Why three appointees of the governor should make a decision about whether or not these employees are a class of employees that A, should be able to collectively bargain, and secondly, which particular union is the appropriate union for them, when what will be bargained for will have, in part, direct control over when they're in the courtroom providing security, under what circumstances they may be in the courtroom providing security, when they're going to be given holidays or not, and what the perks that will affect recruiting and retention will be for those employees. Why is that not so inextricably intertwined with administering the courts that it is inconceivable, yet it would be a decision made by three appointees of the governor working in the executive branch?
Because there are 2 points there, and I think that there may be and let me make that. One is the right to organize and collectively organize and bargain, perhaps. I think your major concern is the scope of bargaining, and most of the questions have led to that. What are you going to talk about? That is down the road. There may well be, as a result of the separation of powers argument, that, you know, and the right of the court to control through Article 4, Section 13, its business, et cetera, that the scope, that many topics of bargaining that would be included generally in PARA would not occur because of the court's special status. Well, that goes to the scope.
Okay, well, your colleague suggested it's quite the other way around, that if you interpreted the existing rules to contemplate collective bargaining, and the rules were embellished to create a system for implementing collective bargaining among judicial branch employees, that it wouldn't be limited in the way in which collective bargaining is limited under the PARA. Is that not correct?
I don't think that has been determined. The scope of bargaining, the way the process works, of course, has been through the unfair labor practice. If someone was to challenge that, there's a way of a mechanism to decide what is the scope. But the, over time,
doesn't that demonstrate the problems in fitting a square peg in a round hole? If you're organized, then I would assume the Superior Court had an obligation to bargain in good faith.
Yes.
And if they say, well, we're not going to bargain with regard to hours because you're going to have to be available when we need you available, so hours are off the table, you work when we want you to work within the total hours people work. Or they say, well, we want to bargain for job security, and the Superior Court says, well, we have a statute that says everybody's at will, we're not bargaining for job security. Then we have the possibility that the union's going to say, well, you know, they're not bargaining in good faith because they're not bargaining at all on the issues that are most important to us.
And PARA has a unfair labor practice process that allows that for those arguments to be made and heard and appeal. That appeals go to the Chancery Court to be heard, and eventually to this court to decide that eventually what the scope of that could be.
Well, and if they're organized, can the bailiffs then say, well, we're not going to come to work, we're going to be on strike until this gets resolved?
Absolutely not. There's a specific state statute, aside from the merit system or otherwise, that prohibits state employees from striking, and that would not be changed under this PARA, absolutely.
Well, and they never have they?
No.
State employees. The statute that prohibits them, has it done a good job of prohibiting them from going on strike?
Well, to the extent there have been, this court has, the court system has remedied it. I can think of two areas that it's happened. One is years and years ago, the state teachers, correct? And that's the only one I can recall, actually.
Is it correct or incorrect that other states have addressed this in their state constitutions themselves as opposed to by statute?
We counted up, there are 29 states that have PARAs similar to Delaware's, okay? Six of them specifically exclude the judicial branch. Of all of the rest of them, the lower courts are included. The two states that the Superior Council for the Superior Court relies on, Michigan and Illinois, exclude the employees of the Supreme Court from coverage. But the lower court employees, and this is Michigan and Illinois, their cases, allow the lower courts to organize. So
is that by case law or constitutional provision?
In Michigan and Illinois is by case law. They use this stands on its head that because the Supreme Court employees are, at least in Michigan and Illinois, is view, this stands on its head because the PERB would be put above the Supreme Court, and that's how Michigan are ruled, which is cited.
Are Michigan and Illinois unified court systems?
In the sense of, I don't think Illinois, in the sense that they have district courts.
In the sense that administering the courts is shared responsibility between towns, cities, counties, regions, and a statewide Supreme Court.
I can't speak specifically to Michigan, Your Honor, but in the interpretations of the Illinois, those same arguments have been made with respect to who is the employer. And in every case that I'm aware of that I can recall, they have been found to be state employees for purposes of the state para statute.
You said earlier there were 11 states that are similarly situated to Delaware that
yes.
have all come out in the way you're advocating. Is that from reading those 11 constitutions, or do we have 11 reported cases?
Well, we have, Your Honor, in our brief, you'll see a large chart divided many different ways. Actually, 18 are explicitly covered through court decisions and otherwise. One group is they have certified judicial employees, so that's to be taken that they're covered the same way that the family court is. There are some case decisions as well. We've divided them a number of different ways. But there are far more, by the way, than just the 11. The 11 cases that I were dealing with is we went back in response to the argument that Delaware is unique in the sense that it has its Article 4, Section 13 powers is unique and we should ignore the rest of the case law from every other jurisdiction. We went back and looked at those constitutional provisions and found 11 states, at least 11 states, that had very similar provisions, including New Jersey and Pennsylvania, where judicial employees, lower court judicial employees, had the right to organize. So it's not that Delaware's constitution, although it's the one we're interpreting, but it's not
the reason they had a right to organize. Was it because the Supreme Courts in those states took the dormant position, or is it because over the opposition of the Chief Justice in the Supreme Court of those states after litigation, the Supreme Court was found to be incorrect in its assertion that only the Chief Justice and the Supreme Court could administer the courts?
Of the 29 cases that have been organized, and the number, I think I was trying to answer, in answering Justice Holland's position, a number of different ways. We've tried to collect in as accurate way as we can to give the court a true survey of what the case law is. 18 of them, I mean, the way I can break it down in the most simplest way is that of the 29 states, there are only, excluding the ones that are not covered, of the six that are excluded specifically by statute, of the 23 remaining, all the lower courts employees are covered for a variety of reasons. Only two states, Michigan and Illinois, have excluded just the Supreme Court.
But what's
cases.
The answer to my question? In those states where they are treated as state employees in the same way in which all other state employees are treated,
yes,
has there been a court decision holding that the Chief Justice and the Supreme Court of that state, despite the constitutional provision allowing them to administer the courts, that constitutional provision did not trump the statute? No, it's not as important to me how it works in practice in those states. Mm-hmm. What's important to me is case precedent that says a state constitutional provision granting authority to the Supreme Court to administer the courts does not trump a statute when the legislative and the executive branches decide that they are better at administering the courts.
I don't have the case exactly on that point, but I do have the Illinois Supreme Court's quote on the issue of the Article 4, Section 13 type power, which says, we should not, and this is a case the state relied on by the Superior Court. In Illinois, another case dealing with lower court judicial employees and allowing them to organize, Kane versus Carlson, 507 Northeast at 482, the Supreme Court says, we should not assume that the administrative and supervisory powers vested in the courts are so broad that every detail affecting personnel must be reserved exclusively to the judicial branch. That was obviously interpreting theirs, but that's the kind of case law I think that the court is looking for. Yes, that case law does exist. In the state of Michigan, for example.
Well, that's close to what I'm looking for.
Okay, let me try. Okay.
It's not a situation where you have dueling options. One, an option to collectively bargain under the personnel rules of the court, and then you have a statutory projection of power to the executive branch to manage the collective bargaining rights of state court employees.
Perhaps I'm missing your point, but both of those states have state statutes allowing state employees to organize.
But the other side of the coin is, did the Chief Justice and the Supreme Court in either of those states say, we have a personnel rule that sets up the framework because this directly affects the extent to which we can process cases? The permutations of collective bargaining as it affects our employees affects the way in which cases will be managed. Therefore, our rule trumps the statute. Or is it simply a vacuum because none of those states had a judicial personnel rule of any kind that purported to speak to collective bargaining?
In my mind right now, I'd obviously be willing to supply supplemental memorandum, but whether there was a rule saying it said the opposite of what the para would imply.
Yeah, it's not inconceivable to me, for example, that a Chief Justice or a state Supreme Court would say, we don't want to be in that business.
Sure.
We in our own minds can differentiate between collective bargaining and processing cases. And there will be some classes of our employees where we make that differentiation more comfortably than others. Bayless in the Superior Court might be one of those subject matter areas where it's very difficult to reach the point of concluding that that doesn't directly affect the way in which cases will be processed and therefore relate wholly to administering the court system.
Yes, perhaps so. I just wanted one final point, that PARA does not require employees to bargain on anything that's contrary to law, inherent managerial policy, or within the exclusive prerogative of the public employer. I think this is in deference to the kinds of concerns that the Chief Justice has raised.
Yeah, then the question becomes, then what do you get for your dues? Don't?
Well, that's always the choice that those employees have before they vote, which is the core of the Paris statute itself, and that is majority rules.
Well, they're walking into a vacuum then, aren't they? They don't know what they're going to be able to bargain for.
I think we start with the para and the mechanism to determine, what is bargaining in good faith, and then to the extent that those objections are raised by the Superior Court, they can be dealt with then. And dividing, again, we're talking about the scope of collective bargaining, not necessarily the ability to organize.
So we can have a whole litigation ladder that ultimately resolves whether the hours that a bailiff has to serve in court is or is not a subject of collective bargaining.
And failure to
agree to the union's idea of the hours is failure to bargain in good faith.
Well, to the extent that would be a scope of bargaining and an objection made and raised in an unfair labor practice, I assume could be filed over anything in the collective bargaining process. But, you have to start somewhere. Certainly there's the rules of, we've had 30 years of negotiations in the family court that can serve as a guide.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to address the last point that was made, it's a little disingenuous. That's not how the system works. There's no such thing as an unfair labor practice until you have a collective bargaining agreement. How long it takes and how difficult and arduous the process is to get to a collective bargaining agreement is controlled by different rules. And those are the rules of opinions by the executive director of the PERB and the PERB and an arbitrator that can't be appealed until it becomes a final decision of the PERB. We've been through that in this case. So unfair labor practices can be appealed to Chancery after the executive director weighs in, her decision is reviewed by the PERB, and then you take the PERB's decision up to Chancery. However, what happens when you have an impasse in collective bargaining and the PERA is absolutely clear about this, is that the employees can force the employer by arguing they're not negotiating in good faith or time is running out, and there's specific, explicit time frames in the statute. If an agreement's about to expire, you have a shorter period of time, but within 90 days, 120 days, there's a 60-day time frame if one's going to expire. There's no agreement on something that you've decided you're not going to bargain on. It's called an impasse, and you go to an arbitrator. Better yet, under the PARA, is that the court would have to foot 50% of the bill and beg the General Assembly to fund that every time there was an impasse to get an arbitrator, unless they agreed that the arbitrator would be the executive director of the PERB. So the only way to get an independent arbitrator is to get another branch of government to agree to give you the funds, because you have to pay 50% under the statute. So I think it's a little disingenuous to talk about unfair labor practice claims when we're talking about scope of bargaining and coming to an agreement. It's an entirely different process for the court. The second point that I wanted to make, I know I'm running out of time, is that I don't think Illinois is a good state to cite as your example. The Kane case was decided before the case that I cite on page 26 of my opening brief, which is the Teamsters case, where Kane's got that yellow flag in Westlaw. Say what you will about it, it's about the lower courts. But when the Supreme Court got this case, and they were asked to address the separation of powers issue, they said that the PLRA in Illinois, same statute as we have here, very similar, threatens a systemic rather than incidental inference with court operation and thus violates separation of powers. In the Michigan case that we cite, and I think this is important, there are dueling constitutional provisions. The Supreme Court has their provisions, very similar to Article 4, Section 13, but the public employees have the right as well to collective bargaining. Michigan came out saying, the courts win, the employees lose there, and you had dual. We don't have that here. That's a closer call in this case.
Ms. Leba, yes, sir. I asked Mr. Bowser the same question that I asked you, specifically, what is the outcome if the Chief Justice's administrative order either precludes collective bargaining or allows it, but provides that the dispute resolution mechanism won't be under PERB or PARA. Mr. Bowser's answer was that even that order would be subject to challenge on the basis that it's not a separation of powers, and that presumably would require the courts, that ultimately this court, to decide that. What is your response?
I disagree with that. I'm sure you're not surprised to hear, and I would be interested in that case to see what dueling constitutional provision the General Assembly of the State of Delaware would point to argue that it has express plenary power over the court employees of this state, because there is no such provision in the Constitution of the State of Delaware. So I'd feel quite confident saying both of those orders would be absolutely legal.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.